Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you to our third oral argument this afternoon, and we have some special guests. We have a coalition of Wisconsin aging groups, and if you would stand so the court can greet you, we'd appreciate that. Thank you very much. Please be seated. We also have some students from East High School in Madison with us. If they would, there some are in our hearing room and some are in our overflow room. Would the East High School students please stand? We're delighted to welcome you all. You may be seated. Many times we have students here with us with our Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program by which we invite students from all over the state to come and join us. And they're given materials about the case and then meet with a justice at noon. And perhaps if some of you are interested, we can persuade a justice to meet with you after this case. The discussion is on the processes of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. Now, the students ordinarily, if they're part of that program, have materials about the case. We have materials available. Our deputy marshal, Mr. Pond, has materials available, which you could quickly read to familiarize yourself with the case. So if you would like such materials, would you raise your hand and he'll distribute them? Have you get there some takers? Good. Okay, and you see our marshal. Tina Dodoff and our deputy marshal, and these have been prepared by the public information officer, Amanda Todd, and I'm stalling before I call the case. So that we get these distributed with least disturbance. Justice Bradley tells me that she met with the senior group over the lunch hour with your Court with Class group. So
they were very well behaved, Chief.
Good. I'm glad. That's terrific. But if anyone else would like to meet, perhaps we can persuade a justice to do that. Now let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and some of you met with her at lunch. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will call our third case, 2003-AP-2180, State versus John R. Maloney. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, John R. Maloney, is attorney Lou A. Wasserman. He will have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin will be Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien. Mr. Wasserman.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon to everyone present. I want to thank the Court for this unusual and second opportunity to address you on the issues in this case. When I came before you the first time, I explained on behalf of John Maloney that there was something in the Court of Appeals opinion that I had spent a lot of time addressing in my briefs, and we spent a lot of time addressing the point that I'm going to get to in a moment at the oral argument in April, and that's this. And this is what I'm going to use to tie together what I think are the remaining loose ends in this case that I think you want to hear about, at least from me. Paragraph 3 of the Court of Appeals opinion. Now, this is a published opinion. Not one of these summary affirmances or per curiam unpublished. This is out for everyone to read. 2000, Wisconsin App 141, paragraph 3. During the course of the investigation, Helen Brown apparently approached investigators and offered to wear a concealed recording device in an attempt to prove Maloney's innocence. The conversations the two shared in Las Vegas were videotaped under supervision of Wisconsin authorities with Helen Brown's consent and cooperation. The conversations, however, contained inculpatory statements from Maloney. With all due respect, maybe my powers of advocacy, to whatever extent I ever had them, have totally failed me, because I put in my briefs, and I said at oral argument, and Mr. O'Brien agreed with me at oral argument, at 42 minutes and 46 seconds into the oral argument, based upon questions that he received from you, that at the time that Tracy Helen Brown was taping John Maloney in Las Vegas, she had a grant of immunity, she no longer believed that Maloney was innocent, and she was working with the police, because she was told on June 8th of 1998, in that meeting at her lawyer's office with Mr. Paulus and the agents present, "Work for us or you're going to jail." That's why she needed the grant of immunity. And why is that important? It's important because when we come to 2005, Wisconsin 74, paragraph 7, it reads, "During the course of the murder investigation, Helen Brown approached the state and offered to wear a concealed recording device in an attempt," this is word for word what's in the Court of Appeals opinion, "according to her, to prove Maloney's innocence. Subsequent conversations that took place in Las Vegas between Helen Brown and Maloney were videotaped under supervision of Wisconsin authorities with Helen Brown's consent and cooperation." Paragraph 8. "Rather than proving Maloney's innocence," which, please, they were never designed to do, and I'll explain why this is very important, "the recorded conversations I'm reading on contained inculpatory statements from him," and it goes on from there. Why is that all important? Number one, because this court, in their decision later on, at paragraph 35, said, "If Helen Brown was not acting under color of law, the videotapes were still admissible at trial," this is Maloney's suggestion, "because she consented to their inception by police and did not do so for the purpose of committing an illegal act. Although Maloney contends that Helen Brown's attempt to record intimidating statements was an injurious act, warranting suppression were not persuasive." Anyone to say that? Paragraph 36, "Like the Court of Appeals, we know of no law that suggests an individual who volunteers to aid the authorities." Volunteers? She did it because if she didn't, she was going to go to jail. If that's a volunteer, that's a volunteer. But that's not the facts of this case.
No, she was going to go to jail under what was the pretext? What was
the... It would have been filing false statements to get her job. It wasn't state court. It was a federal matter, the kind that gets prosecuted all the time, the kind for which carries maximum penalties of 5 years in prison, $100,000 fine.
Well, when they said you can go to jail, of course, that means that she would have been entitled to all of the rights and privileges. She wasn't going directly there from the time of the conversation. That's a euphemism, going to jail. In other words, they were going to press charges. That's what...
She had already admitted to the misconduct that would have been the subject of a federal prosecution, and that's why the grant of immunity. Please, I mean, she's there at this June 8th meeting. She has counsel. And so, now, the final part of this that I think is important is, ultimately, in the opinion, this court suggests that at note 16, even if there was some sort of a violation of the Wisconsin Electronic Surveillance Control Law, we note that Helen Brown could still have taken the witness stand at trial and testified about her encounter with Maloney in Las Vegas. This is sort of a harmless error type of analysis. It doesn't say so explicitly, but I think that's where the court was going. Now, what I think is ultimately really important about that, as you know from appendix page 117 of the supplemental brief, and that is that this is Joe Paulus' list of weaknesses of his case. Tracy, lack of cooperation, that's different than being a volunteer, past history of lying. So while it may be true that Helen Brand could have testified on her own as to the conversations that took place in Las Vegas in July of 1998, that's a different case than the case with the tapes. Because as Joe Paulus knew and was fully explored at trial, Tracy Helen Brand lied, did so consistently, and was not cooperating with police. So that would have been a completely different case. Now, the list of weaknesses is crucial as well, because if you read through them in their entirety, I won't do that, you've got it before you, but if you read them through them in their entirety, one of the things that becomes abundantly clear is that this list by Mr. Paulus is made after he has signed the criminal complaint, swearing that there's probable cause to believe that John Maloney had killed his about-to-be ex-wife.
You're not saying that because there are weaknesses in the case that shows there was no probable cause, are you, Counselor?
I'm suggesting this. This memo, I am, and I'll tell you why. This memo doesn't come about prior to the time that the criminal complaint is signed. This memo is written after the criminal complaint is signed. But when you read through it, it is exactly what you suggest, and that is that a litany of reasons why there is not probable cause. Fundamentally important, down at the bottom, last three lines. John never admitted to setting the fire or killing Sandy. John's numerous underlined statements on tape that he didn't kill Sandy. But that's not what is in the criminal complaint. That's not in the criminal complaint. And that's not the way this case was pursued.
Mr. Wasserman, let me, if I might, interrupt you for just a minute. And I don't mean to get you off track, but this is something that is of concern to me. Both you and the state indicate that we have the authority to continue jurisdiction here in this court and to remand this matter to the trial court, to the circuit court, for a hearing in regard to what would, in effect, be a 974.06 motion. The question I have is, if we were to do that, basically, what witnesses would you call or what evidence would you expect to present at such a hearing?
Your Honor, they would be the witnesses, and there would be others, but there would be those that correspond precisely to the information that I put into the appendix. And that means, all I have to do is look at my appendix table of contents. Richard Dirks from Minnesota, who helped Paulus alter the tapes. Brian Del Monte, who actually did the editing. Dr. Schmunk. Michael Sagerson, who analyzed the tapes. That's at page 123, and you can see that testimony from someone like Michael Sagerson goes directly to the issue of the tapes being and the transcripts being altered. Lorraine Hens, who reviewed discrepancies between the audio portions of the videotapes and the transcripts. Dr. Munger, Dr. Dibden, and especially in an arson case, maybe calling it a smoking gun is a really cheap sort of metaphor, but Fire Captain William Bartlett, who indicates at page 146 and 147 and 148, these are the findings that you've heard so much about, those initial Brown County Arson Task Force findings indicating that the fire was not a set fire. Or at least it's a fact in dispute at the very least. If we were talking about a summary judgment motion, I would say to you, well, they say it was, but we say it isn't. and under that analysis, you would send it back to the trial court to let the jury resolve the issue. So I think that the burden here is the Bentley-Allen burden. Have we given to you sufficient information so that you understand what it is that we're claiming, and at least enough facts so, if true, relief would be warranted? I believe that is the standard. I think Mr. Bryan and I agree that that would be the standard.
Now, you're claiming, as I understand it, that the real controversy was not tried here. Is that correct?
Exactly. The real controversy comes down to there's three aspects of it. Was there an arson? Was there a homicide? And did John Maloney, like Mr. Paulus maintained at trial, confess in that hotel room in Las Vegas in July of 1998? So, but in addition to the real controversy not being tried, I am also claiming that the information that I've given to you is sufficient to state a claim of a miscarriage of justice. There is some overlap here. I mean, the facts are basically the same. They go in my view, in both directions.
Counsel, would any of these witnesses provide newly discovered evidence on our test for newly discovered evidence with which I'm sure you're familiar?
Yes. Some do and some don't.
Which ones do?
Well, those people that are working off of the information obtained from Mr. Dirks in Minnesota. Now, but this is all information that came to light after the prosecutor's file was discovered someplace, either in the office of the district attorney or the office of the clerk of Brown County. And then because of open records requests, all filed, and I just want to make sure that we're together on this point, after the 974-06 motion is filed. So in that sense, that information is newly discovered. The information from Dr. Dibden and Dr. Munger, no, that's not really newly discovered evidence. It is, I guess I would call it newly analyzed evidence. But now the significance of it becomes, I think, at least from our point of view, it was sort of all is beginning to gel together. But yes, it's clearly some of both.
Counsel?
Yes.
There is some validity, of course, into the finality of judgments.
Yes.
We have the statute that gives an opportunity for relief if the real controversy hasn't been tried, as you indicate, or justice has been miscarried. So balancing that, I need, with the idea of importance of finality, I need your assistance in understanding why some of these discrepancies that you put forth in your brief make any difference. Why does it make any difference, and this plays off Justice Rogensack's question, that there's a list of weaknesses? I'm writing an opinion, and I have a list of weaknesses in my opinion, too, you know.
Yes.
That wasn't supposed to be really funny, anyway. The fact that in the transcript, and there are court reporters who've gone over the transcript and the tapes. Now, the tapes, 6 hours of the tapes, I think, were played to the jury, if I remember correctly, and that there are some words in a couple of instances missing or not exactly correct, even though they had the video and they were watching the video. I mean, why do those things unravel the conviction of the jury?
If I can't make Mr. O'Brien's argument, then I can't make my own. So I'm going to make his and answer your question. His argument is, Maloney had a trial. Then he had post-conviction motion. Then he had a direct appeal. Filed a petition for review. Then files a 974-06. That goes to the Court of Appeals. It comes here. It's been denied at every level. You know, when is it over? This is Mr. O'Brien's argument, and I understand that argument. Well,
and the second part of his argument is, as I wrote under my brief, which I didn't bring it in here, I put his second part of his argument takes several pages, but it can be, I think, capsulized in two words. So what?
Yeah.
I mean, that is, so what?
that there's a list of weaknesses. So what that there's some missing words in a transcript? So what?
And, you know, federal law in the for what it's worth category says the same thing when we're talking about the Effective Death Penalty Act and termination of litigation in federal court. It says the same thing. You only get so many kicks at the cat, but there's always, even at every level, there's always an exception. And the exception is called actual innocence. And that's where this is going. Because the information that we have supplied, first of all, it has to be determined whether or not it's true or not true. At least traditionally, that's always been the function of a trier of fact, which this court isn't. But frankly, given the tour de force of the Armstrong case, maybe that's going to change as well. Maybe this is the time and the place to do that. I mean, the Armstrong case talks about, you know, inherent authority and plenary authority and just absolutely, it's stratospheric in terms of this court assuming the what I call the right to vertically cut through all levels of litigation to get at what is really the heart of the matter. What we're saying is this. All of these seemingly little independent, none of them by themselves, smoking gun little items do add up to something. They do add up to the fact that the jury didn't hear that the Brown County Arson Task Force initially determined that there wasn't an arson. They didn't hear, in fact, that John Maloney said he didn't do it on the tape because it looks like the tapes were altered. How was that done? And that comes back to the witnesses.
Didn't he ever say on the tapes, I didn't do it?
Well, I've got that in here. I think the answer to that is unequivocally yes, but that's not what the jury heard, and that wasn't what was on the transcript. In the versions that I've supplied from those people that looked at the tape and looked at the transcript, appendix page 124. This is Lorraine Hennis. In my opinion, the transcript should read as follows. I'm sorry, I have to back up. Page 53 of the transcript at approximately 5:47:48. That's the time on the tape. The transcript reads, John, I know that, you're right, and I am, Tracy, I know you killed her. I am ill, John. Right, in response to a question. Lorraine Hennis says, this is where the transcript should read, and what the jury did not hear. John, I know that, you're right, and I am, Tracy, I know you killed her. John says, I'm ill. No, I didn't, Trace. There's other examples. I come back to the list of weaknesses. Madam Justice, you asked me, what does this list mean? We all have.
Before you go back to the list of weaknesses, I want to stay on the tapes for a moment. I know it's certainly inferred or implied that these tapes were somehow doctored, but I've also looked at Mr. O'Brien's response that if these tapes were indeed doctored, that you've got to look beyond Mr. Paulus, you've got to look at the police departments, you've got to look at other entities, the Las Vegas filming crew. Do we have anything here? Do we have enough evidence here to even go into looking whether or not we're dealing with, quote, doctored tapes versus just a mistranscription that had a couple of errors?
I would analyze it two ways. The first thing I would look at is, oftentimes I have clients tell me, sitting in the middle of the trial, and he says, you know, the guy said I was wearing a red shirt. I was wearing a burgundy shirt. And I said, well, so what? These differences aren't like that. These differences aren't insignificant. So let's go, this is what I suggest. Let's go back.
The reason I'm trying to pin you down is because you've mentioned Armstrong. You haven't mentioned Love, but I assume you will. But when I look at those two cases, I look at how the evidence in those cases were used, and it was far more, there was a lot more evidence there where the prosecutor was arguing this is what this evidence shows, when indeed the evidence didn't show that, versus this case where, if I'm understanding the briefs correctly, you may have some discrepancies, but the bulk of what's there, of what the jury has heard, is there. So what I'm trying to get at is, are we talking degrees? Are we talking a more difficult problem? Because it might make a difference in how we analyze the case.
Yes. It, again, does appear to be some of both. But the reason that those that I think are critical and those that I think may be less critical are important is because they're all tied together. And they're tied together because once you understand what the prosecution thought of the weaknesses and compare the weaknesses on page 117 to the apparent changes that these witnesses that are included in the rest of the appendix talk about, they dovetail perfectly. All of the weaknesses that Joe Paul has mentioned in terms of what John said or John did apply to the changes that were made to the tapes. They don't have to be a lot. It doesn't have to be changing every word and every line, changing every sound. The information that we have developed since 2004 indicates that the real tapes, the ones that popped out of the machine in the hotel, are fairly clear. But the ones that were played at trial are not. That caused, if you will, the trier of fact, which is what counts here, to rely more on the transcripts than on the audio portion of the tape. And the transcripts aren't accurate in fundamental ways. And they were inaccurate enough for the state to obtain their conviction. So it's not harmless error because instead of saying, I did it, saying, no, I didn't do it.
Well, I guess part of the reason I'm asking the question is that, for example, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, defense counsel had the original tapes, correct?
We believe that to be true.
All right. So if defense counsel had the original tapes and didn't act on the discrepancies at the time, it might make a difference if we're not talking about doctored tapes. If we're dealing with the transcription error, you've got one version here, you've got enhanced tapes, everybody agrees to use the enhanced tapes, both parties had the evidence. That's a different case than saying the tapes were sent out, they were altered, they were doctored, and the jury heard false evidence. At least it makes a difference to me.
Well, the only thing I can say is that when I say we believe that may be true, we don't really know that's true. Meaning, what tapes did John Maloney's counsel originally have? Because the tapes were enhanced virtually. The audio portions of them were. That was dealt with much before the Dirks work in Minnesota, which comes just a couple of weeks before trial. So, but you're right, you would think that sitting there in February of 1999, you'd be able to say to yourself, that isn't, you know, what I heard when these tapes were first turned over. And you would think that the prosecutor sitting there maybe thinking to himself, boy, am I going to get away with this or not? And yes, that's probably different. You're hoping that he doesn't, and you're hoping that defense counsel sees it. The evidence here, though, suggests that, and I would suggest that the ultimate responsibility for what the jury heard wasn't Maloney's or his counsel's, because it wasn't proffered by them, wasn't marked by them, wasn't introduced by them. It came from the special prosecutors, both of them. And if they were sitting there thinking to themselves, boy, we're really lucky that they didn't notice this, that doesn't change the scenario that the evidence strongly suggests that significant and highly incriminating portions of the tapes and the transcripts were changed to make them fit, if you will, or to eliminate the line through the weaknesses that the prosecutor knew that he had in this case. Which brings me back to another point, and I know this was a concern, and that's, you really don't even really want to believe that this is possible. You don't. But the cameras aren't here just because John Maloney's in jail, they're here because the special prosecutor's in jail, because he corrupted the judicial system at the very same time that he was prosecuting John Maloney. And that's why it's crucial. May I say one more thing, and that's this.
Very quickly, please.
Yes. This court has the authority to remand. This court has the authority to even do more, and I'll address that when I get back up, maybe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. Mr. O'Brien?
May it please the court. This court has many times in the past reversed convictions and ordered new trials in the interests of justice. This court has, however, never ordered a new trial in the interests of justice based on anything other than cold, hard evidence that went directly to the question of guilt or innocence. Mr. Maloney wants this court to now deviate from that tried and true course. He would like a new trial based on a slurry of rumor, innuendo, half-baked conspiracy theories, and half-truths. This court should not accept that invitation.
Well, can we sort that out by remanding for an evidentiary hearing?
And I would say that this court should not order an evidentiary hearing for the same reasons, that his motion does not present the type of hard and cold proof that goes directly to the question of guilt or innocence that would coax a trial judge into ordering an evidentiary hearing under the Bentley-Allen-Love standards. Under 751.06, this court has the authority to order a new trial in the interest of justice, and I think you can extrapolate from that the authority to order for additional fact-finding if, and I quote from the statute, it appears from the record that the real controversy has not been fully tried. First of all, as we have seen from counsel's brief, in order to obtain relief here, this court has to go outside the record along with him to order a hearing. And as far as the real controversy being tried, counsel said, and I was wondering this as well as Justice Bradley, I think, asked the question, well, what is the real controversy here? Counsel said the real controversy was there A, arson, was B, was it a homicide by Mr. Maloney, and C, did Mr. Maloney confess in the Las Vegas videotapes? That real controversy was fully tried before the jury. All those issues were in play at trial, and that jury rejected that defense version of the controversy beyond a reasonable doubt. And Mr. Maloney offers nothing of substance to call that controversy into question. And there remains the question of, well, if this is ordered for retrial, what would the controversy be then? And it's not clear. From what I can coalesce from everything that has been offered in this case up to this point, there are varying theories. One is, well, she was killed, but it might have been by somebody other than either John Maloney or Tracy Hellenbrand, or B, she drank herself to death, or C, she committed suicide, or D, she attempted to commit suicide in the basement, failed, staggered upstairs, then drank herself to death, E, she attempted suicide, drank herself to death, fell asleep on the couch, knocked over a vodka bottle, and set a fire and killed herself, or E or F, where I'm at, all of the above, or some of the above, or G, let's just put the special prosecutor on trial. None of those are appropriate.
Isn't that really the essence of the argument, though, here? And isn't that why we're here, is that there are some concerns about the special prosecutor? And isn't that essentially what opposing counsel is asking us to do, is to acknowledge those kinds of concerns and simply because of that to grant relief?
But I think you need to I think that is what he's asking for.
Right.
And I think in the conclusion of my brief, I refer to that as a get-out-of-jail-free card, simply by virtue of the fact that the prosecutor committed misconduct in unrelated cases. Therefore, every case he ever prosecuted is open for retrial. I think you need more.
Mr. O'Brien, let me ask you just to follow up on that. If there were misconduct in this case, would that make a difference for you?
Well, it would certainly be a concern. I think you have to look at the nature of the misconduct. I mean, if it's something trivial, I mean, And I, you know, I'd hate to speculate what that might be as opposed to something that would be sufficiently serious to warrant relief. But I think you'd have to look at the nature of the misconduct. I mean, we have all seen cases of unethical conduct by lawyers on both sides of the fence that should not have occurred at trial but don't affect the outcome. But the question, you know, obviously it reaches a point where it becomes sufficiently egregious that it impacts the question of guilt or innocence.
And the reason I ask the question is, as I understand it, and I'm looking at some work that was prepared for me by my staff, I know we had a John Doe petition that was proceeding. Is that concluded yet?
Well, my understanding is, based on the letter appended to the reply brief, that the Winnebago County John Doe is on hold at this point, and I can tell the court that the Department of Justice is in the process of investigating all aspects of possible criminal conduct by Mr. Paulus.
And the reason I ask that is this case in a proper posture, given those two investigations that are taking place, or should we be awaiting the outcome of those investigations?
Well, I think that's a good question, because one of the questions earlier was, who would be the witnesses at this hearing? And Mr. Wasserman listed quite a few, but he forgot some. Some of the other witnesses would be the people who transcribed the video or the audio tapes at the Department of Justice. Some of the other witnesses would be the Milwaukee Police Department officers who did the audio enhancement of the videos. Then, of course, there'd be the people from forensic video. And then there would be presumably both prosecutors, both defense attorneys. I'm forgetting others, but there would be others. What it would be that it could be like another John Doe hearing, operating in the public eye simultaneously with at least one ongoing secret John Doe proceeding. And I guess at this, you know, I'd also like at this point to state that to the extent that I might want to discuss the Department of Justice John Doe proceeding, there is a secrecy order in place, so I'm quite limited in what I can say about that. But I think there is a real concern here. On the other hand, if either or both John Doe proceedings come up with exculpatory evidence that can be presented in a motion, then that could be a future claim for relief.
But don't we then run into Escalona?
Not if there's sufficient reason. And if there was sufficient reason for not presenting, such as ineffective assistance of counsel, or it just couldn't have been discovered, or it was intentionally concealed, or something along those lines, then I think you'd have a pretty good argument to get around Escalona.
Were there any discovery violations by the state in this case?
I am aware of none. No one has ever alleged that there was a discovery violation. I don't recall trial counsel ever complaining about discovery. In fact, if I recall, my review of the pretrial hearings was that things were quite cooperative, quite amicable, and certainly at the post-conviction stage, I don't recall any argument at either of the two prior post-conviction hearings that there were any discovery violations by the state.
Also, I would like to particularly go through the videotape. I've read both briefs. You heard what opposing counsel had to say as far as he said that the special prosecutor altered these tapes. I mean, that was what he said here. Do you know, I think there were different copies of this, that the jury, do you know of, and I didn't see it in the briefs, that the version that was heard up in Green Bay is the same version that you have in your possession now? In other words...
Well, I don't have anything in my possession.
Okay, well, I mean in the state's possession.
Yes, in the state. My understanding is that the original tapes, the original videotapes from Las Vegas, were, with the agreement of defense counsel, sent out for an enhancement by the Milwaukee Police Department for audio enhancement. And with the agreement of defense counsel, they were transcribed by program assistants in the Wisconsin Department of Justice Department of Criminal Investigations Unit. That transcription was done. That audio enhancement was done. Defense counsel at a pretrial hearing reviewed the transcripts and said, they're about as close as you can get. Obviously, the tape is the best evidence, but I have no problem with those transcripts coming in. And those enhanced and transcribed tapes were played for the jury in their entirety, and the jurors were each provided individual copies of the transcripts to review as they watched the video monitor. And those tapes were available to the jury if they wanted them during deliberations. Finally, the special prosecutor, with the full knowledge of defense counsel, had these tapes edited down for closing argument because the judge made it clear to the attorneys, you're not going to be playing that whole tape during closing argument. That's 6 hours. So the special prosecutor had it sent out for editing down to show clips during his argument. And this came as no surprise to defense counsel. Now, he might not have known that Forensic Video in Minneapolis was the one who edited the tape, but he did know that he had to know it was edited because he saw the edited version as it was played to the jury, and presumably he was aware of it long before then. That version was shown to the jury. No one objected on the ground that, hey, that edited version isn't the same as what we just, the 6 hours that we just saw. And, you know, one might argue that, well, maybe Attorney Boyle knew or should have objected, but he overlooked it. But there's never been any claim that Attorney Boyle was ineffective on that basis. More importantly, Mr. Maloney was sitting right there next to counsel. Mr. Maloney was the only one who was in that hotel room with Tracy Hellebrand. Mr. Maloney knew what he did and said in that room on July 25th through 27th. And believe you me, if he had seen something materially different from what he said or did, I've got to believe that he would have said to Mr. Boyle, hey, object right now, or judge, my attorney's not objecting, but this is wrong. We need to take the jury off, something like that. Nothing like that happened.
Mr. O'Brien, weren't the actual tapes 9 hours long?
The original tapes were 9 hours.
Yet from 9 hours to 6 hours.
Because 9 hours covers the period July 25 through 27. The six-hour tape that actually was played was the most, was the critical day, which was the full day of July 27. And that's the six-hour tape. And that's played in its entirety. So we don't have, my recollection is that nothing was played for the jury from either July 25 or July 27. Those were much shorter encounters than July 25 or 6 or whatever. I'm confusing myself, but. And the brief makes it clear, but it's a one-day tape that's 6 hours long, and it basically, my understanding goes from basically morning till evening, and it includes time, though she's out of the room, and that sort of thing. And that's the tape that includes the, I might add, the violent outburst by Mr. Maloney that not only is captured on tape, but was witnessed by Las Vegas police officers in the adjoining room.
Now, the reduction from 9 hours to 6 hours, was that done with the knowledge and consent of counsel and the defendant?
There was no objection, and I don't think there's even any claim now that that mere fact of it wasn't reduced from 9 to 6 hours.
I understand that only 6 hours was played and portions not played.
Correct. And I don't think there's any claim relative to that. It's more the claim was relative to the 6 hour tape that was played and the editing and the enhancement and the transcription of that 6 hour tape. At least if my understanding is correct.
Mr. O'Brien, you're familiar with the governor's partial veto power, where words can be struck out to completely change the sense of a sentence. Is there any alteration of this tape that leads to a completely different conclusion, either an addition or a deletion, to a different assertion than what was on the original tape?
I honestly don't know. All I can tell you is this. If there were alterations, I'd be surprised if there weren't, let's put it that way, because we are, after all, dealing with 6 hours of tape of varying quality that has to be transcribed, that has to be enhanced, and one person listening to it might hear something that another person doesn't. One person seeing it might see something that another person does. But what I would tell you is this. Even assuming what they allege is correct and that there were one or two points where a denial was not included in the transcript or a denial was somehow not on the audio enhanced version, the fact remains, and I think I pointed out at some length, if I recall, I think it's pages 18 and 19 on the brief, where not only is it apparent from the remainder of the videos that were shown to the jury that he denied many times on that video, as well as on videos of July 7th and June 18th, that there's no question raised regarding those videos. And on those videos, he denied to Tracy Hellenbrand any involvement. And then on these, or at least denied killing his wife. And then on these, on page 18, 19, I think I point out that the bulk of it, there's no dispute. It actually is conceded by the prosecutor in closing argument that, yes, he did deny this many times. But that doesn't change the fact that there's, you know, strong evidence to show that he in fact did it. And that eventually he did make some admissions on the tape.
What I'm trying to get at, is there any editing that turns something from white to black or black to white? No, a deletion is one thing. But is there anything that turns black to white or vice versa?
I mean, they allege it, but I'm certainly unaware of that. And certainly if the editing for purposes of closing argument had turned white to black or black to white, someone would have said something. I mean, it appears from the record that even the trial judge reviewed these tapes before trial. You think he might have caught it, even if the attorneys were asleep. But I am unaware of anything other than their bare, unsubstantiated allegations that there was a material alteration. And it's just counterintuitive, again, because everyone was there. Everyone saw it. Mr. Maloney was actually in the hotel room. If there was a material change in this tape, someone would have said something at the appropriate time, or at the very least, at either the first or the second post-conviction stage. And nobody said anything. This is basically an attempt. This is not really an attempt to obtain a new trial in the interest of justice. This is just an attempt to obtain a new trial to present another alternative defense strategy to the one that failed. And that is not a proper basis for seeking a new trial in the interest of justice. Anyone can look at a record years after the fact and say, boy, you know, I wonder if there was some problem with that evidence, or I wonder if our expert would say something differently now. And I'd say 9 times out of 10, you can always find some flaw, some fly speck in a transcript, or some questionable testimony that might create a doubt or might create a concern about the validity of a piece of evidence or a particular witness's testimony. But if we were in a new trial just based on that, then no longer have an interest in the finality of criminal convictions, and the interest in the protection of victims goes out the window.
Mr. O'Brien, just so that we're all on the same page, my understanding of the request here is not to order a new trial, but to order a remand for a hearing to determine whether there are grounds for a new trial. And so I just want to make sure we're talking the same thing when we discuss this case. And once again, I come back. Is there a difference for you? I'm not sure I get an answer. If there were evidence of misconduct on the part of the special prosecutor versus the case being tried in a different manner, as you've just argued now.
Well,
you see a distinction.
I think I don't want to concede that any time a prosecutor commits misconduct is automatic reversal. I don't think that's ever been the case law here. I mean, I think you still have to look at the impact on the trial. So to say, if there was misconduct per se, that doesn't necessarily require due process. In fact, 751.06 requires a showing that the misconduct prevented the real controversy from being tried or created such a miscarriage of justice that there's a substantial probability of a different result. So it seems to me that that misconduct has to satisfy those two prongs of 751.06.
Do we not have an interest in protecting the integrity of our criminal justice system?
Certainly. Certainly. We also have an interest in protecting the integrity of validly obtained jury verdicts and in the finality of criminal convictions and in protecting the interests of the victims and the victims' families.
Are you able to tell us whether the Department of Justice John Doe in any way relates
to the Maloney case, or do you feel you're under such a secrecy order that you can't even disclose the nature of that inquiry?
I guess what I would state is that the probe is looking into all aspects, my understanding is anyways, of all aspects of potential criminal conduct by Mr. Paulus. That would, if there's criminal conduct related to that case, to this case, I guess I would assume that it would encompass that. Beyond that, I really, I'm not at liberty to step, but also I really don't know beyond that exactly.
I don't want you to violate whatever the order is in the John Doe. I just want to get as much information as we can get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, I think it is pretty clear also that the Winnebago John Doe, when or if it starts up again, does encompass this case. And again, if either of those produce exculpatory evidence, that will be available. And that will, that may, in the appropriate time, spur an appropriate motion based on the newly discovered evidence claim, which we know can be brought at any time, presuming you can satisfy 974-06's requirements.
John Doe's can go on a long time. In the meantime, you've got somebody sitting in prison.
Well, on the other hand, a lot of defendants sitting in prison don't even have the benefit of ongoing John Doe investigations, and their attorneys go out and do the legwork to find the evidence that's out there. And it's certainly nothing is preventing Mr. Maloney's counsel from doing that and having his own investigators come up with something maybe a little stronger than what he's come up with so far.
You don't think we should just wait for the John Doe, or do you? You think we should just...
I don't think there's any need to, because I think you... If it produces new exculpatory evidence, then it's likely that he will be able to fashion a motion that would require a hearing in the circuit court. And on that question, whether it meets the criteria as this court most recently discussed in the Armstrong case, and whether the motion sufficiently meets the criteria in the Love Allen situation. I mean, that can be, and if it doesn't, then there shouldn't be relief. I mean, I guess that's the other side of the coin. You know, this is his, let's not forget, this is his third bite of the apple. And it seems to me it behooves him to come up with something quite strong to overcome not only the validity of the jury's verdict, but the validity of the prior Court of Appeals decisions, rejecting his many challenges, including the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence to convict. And at this point, we would submit that he falls far short. Whether to remand for an evidentiary hearing, I'd say this court could independently state, based upon his offering so far, that there's an insufficient basis to even submit it to the circuit court to determine whether there should be a new trial in the interest of justice or whether there should be a hearing. This court could just simply deny that and allow him to go back, and if he can come up with evidence that meets the Armstrong 5-part test, then fine. He has that vehicle available to him. He's always had that vehicle available to him. There's no reason to add an extra layer of procedure, really an avenue of relief that's available to no other criminal defendant. If he wants relief at this late date, then the state suggests he's got to come up with something a lot more than the rumor, speculation, and conspiracy theories that are being presented here. And it's got to be something more than just the fact, the undisputed fact, that the prosecutor was convicted of soliciting bribes in traffic cases. There's got to be something tied to the question of guilt or innocence. And so far, he hasn't presented that sufficient link as has been established in all of the other cases, coming back to my opening point, in all of the other cases where this court has ordered a new trial in the interests of justice. Let's see. Now, again, there is a real legitimate question as to what type of hearing this would be, what the scope of the hearing would be. Every indication from Mr. Wasserman's response, it would be an open-ended fishing expedition that would take weeks, if not months, to complete. It would far outlast the length of the trial and really would establish a lot of tangential points that do not go directly to the issue of guilt or innocence. Perhaps this case can be reduced to simple mathematical formulas. 2 plus 2 equals 4, and 0 plus 0 equals 0. The state put 2 and 2 together at trial and proved four things. Sandy Maloney died, John Maloney killed her, Sandy Maloney was burned to death, and John Maloney set the fire. Mr. Maloney is trying to put 2 and 2 together to create 5. He can't do that, and what he's offered is 0, and 0 plus 0 equals 0. Unless there are any additional questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Wasserman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. 2 plus 2 equals 4. And that includes that, according to Mr. O'Brien, that John Maloney set the fire, John Maloney killed his wife. That goes back to the issue of whether or not this case was fully tried. That was asked to Mr. O'Brien. And he said it was fully tried. Everything was litigated. But that's not true either. As you know from reading the case, the issue as to whether or not Sandy Maloney was murdered was not contested. That means it wasn't litigated. The issue of whether or not there was an arson...
But that was a tactical decision by defense counsel, was it not?
Well, yes. But why? Because of what they didn't know. And then faced with what they didn't know, they apparently made that choice to agree that Sandy Maloney was murdered, to agree that there was an arson set to cover it up, although there's a nexus between the two, even in the minds of the people that testified for the state, agreed to it. And then simply took, as I pointed out in my brief, what I think is the bizarre, but not necessarily contravening Strickland, tactic of trying to pin it on Tracy Hellenbrand. But there was no evidence that Tracy Hellenbrand committed a murder or an arson. Some of those issues weren't fully tried. And Mr. O'Brien says this is just rumor and innuendo speculation. I'm sorry, these are sworn affidavits that indicate that the transcripts don't match up with the original tapes and that the alterations to the transcripts that were made are more incriminating than what was on the original tapes. I mean, I don't know how you call that rumor an innuendo. It's fact. It's a fact that there is someone who is qualified to say so who does say so.
But my question, Mr. Wasserman, is as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is fact that you have discrepancies between the original transcript and the so-called enhanced transcript, or between the original transcript and or the original tape and the enhanced tape, and between the original tape and the transcript. That's my understanding of what the fact is. But you have transcription issues all the time. We get them in transcripts that come up here to the court. Unless you have more, do we have enough to act on? In other words, unless you can point to the fact that the discrepancies are a result of the wrongful conduct of the special prosecutor, all that was before defense counsel at the time. Are you entitled to a second kick at the cat?
Yes, I understand that in theory that defense counsel, Mr. Bryan even takes it a step further. He says, well, why didn't John Maloney himself jump up? I don't know what rule of law that is, that the defendant himself is required to make his own objections when his counsel isn't doing it. That I don't know what rule of law that is. Let's blame John Maloney for his own conviction. He was in Las Vegas. He knew it was on those tapes. Well, you know, maybe he did, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I mean, if you take a look at the tapes, you'll see that it's frantic, sort of out of control, and then, you know, 6-7 months later, you're supposed to remember everything that you said and make your own objections. Did the special prosecutor alter the tapes? The answer seems to be, from the evidence that we have now brought to bear after the open records request The answer is yes. And he had the help of the video service in Minnesota, Dirks. Jeannie Anthony's affidavit makes that clear. And when Richard Dirks took a look at the tape that he was given, he said, this tape's been changed. This tape's been worked on already. That's in the affidavit beginning on page 101. But he knew that already. So it's unfortunate that perhaps counsel didn't catch it at trial. But that's not the same thing as saying they just want another kick at the cat with a different theory. This isn't the same thing as just another theory. Let me explain. I did a homicide trial a couple of weeks ago. No matter how many times I might get to retry that case, I'm not going to be able to change the fact that the victim was shot 4 times at close range. Nothing is ever going to change that. This case is quite different, because in this case there is a real issue as to cause of death and whether or not there was an arson. Just look at the Bartlett report, the initial Arson County Task Force report that says this was caused by careless smoking. The jury never heard that, and they should have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for your argument again in this case. That closes the hearing on 2003-AP-2180, State v. Maloney. The court will meet in conference at 3:05. We are in recess. Tomorrow the court meets with PPAC. On Friday the court has open conference. Friday we have closed conference, and on Monday we have open conference. So we have a lot of days facing us. We are in recess.